like for a committed writer, television can be a little dangerous just because it's very easy money for the work compared to writing. Just a lot of TV, I think, and start making a lot of money at it, it can make writing feel very, very hard. And so maybe I was always a little guarded about that. The collect question of how a Jerry Sandusky could have prospered the way he did in that environment involves so many more people and questions than just what Joe Paterno did or should have done. You know, it's really an enormous question that's very hard to get your hands around.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer's Bette Marston. And this week, our guest is the fine Washington Post sports columnist, Sally Jenkins. You know her work from a couple decades now at the Washington Post, also a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, wrote some great pieces for this place. And Sally also, of course, has had numerous best-selling books, including with Lance Armstrong and Pat Summitt. Last person to interview Joe Paterno, at least in terms of long form, I believe. We'll talk to her about that. And, you know, she's someone who's been very tough on Roger Goodell, very tough on the Washington teams. And you can make the argument, maybe it's not, that's probably the wrong way to phrase it, but I think she's the most prominent female sports writer in the country. I'm not talking about sports personalities. She's obviously not somebody who appears on ESPN and FS1, et cetera, but sort of in terms of writing, I think she's the most prominent. So I want to ask her, too, where the where she sees the future of this business for women, especially as newspapers continue to fold and cities are one newspaper towns. Be interested to see what her take is on, will women go into sports writing as opposed to sort of multimedia brands. But I'm really excited to have her. She's a really interesting interview. If you've seen her, which you've probably seen her on, you know, Charlie Rose or C-SPAN. She's just, you know, she's good. She knows her stuff, to be blunt. All right. So I believe Sally is somewhere in New York City. So let's bring on Sally Jenkins. And I will say that a little bit of the audio is going to be a little choppy, at least at the beginning. But Bette Marston, the genius that she is, was able to figure it out. So it gets a little better as the interview goes along. All right. As promised, we bring in Sally Jenkins, the longtime sports columnist of the Washington Post, New York Times best-selling author, and one of the people I really respect in the business and always a must-read. Sally Jenkins, thank you very much for being part of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for the flattering intro.
The check is in the mail, Sally. Or your check should be in the mail, I should say. Let's start off with a general question. How do you find your subjects and the stories you write about?
I got a good piece of advice a while back from somebody who said, what's bugging you? So as a sports columnist, a lot of times all I'm trying to do is home in on what might be bothering me. You know, if you watch a certain issue play out in the press, whether it's Deflategate, and something is sort of nagging at you and you don't quite know, you know, what's bugging you, a lot of times if you go at that pressure point and you drill down and find out what really is bothering, it turns into a good column. I think that's the starting point is, you know, you look for sort of the itch, you know, what doesn't feel quite right or sound quite right. What, you know, is prevailing wisdom really wise, or is the counterpoint maybe smarter? That's something my dad, you know, Dan Jenkins is my dad, legendary Sports Illustrated writer, and he always told me, you know, look at the prevailing wisdom and then look at the other side and ask yourself if it isn't smarter. And a lot of times I just try to follow his advice on that.
Sally, you're someone who's written at different lengths. As a columnist for the Washington Post, you have whatever your length of your column is, 800, 1200 words. And obviously you've written long form in terms of books, certainly written profiles. Are you a different writer when you write at different lengths? And if so, how are you a different writer at those lengths?
Absolutely. I think, you know, they all take different muscles. It's sort of like running different distances. You know, it's very tempting to think of it in athletic terms. or, you know, sometimes you maybe think of it in terms of being a pitcher. You know, you're trying to throw different pitches. You're trying to throw a curveball. You know, sometimes an 800-word column can be just a real fastball, you know, just a really short, declarative, forceful statement, whereas a feature story on a personality, you're really trying to let them take over the story and get yourself out of the way. You're trying to let their character emerge through impressions that they've made on you. So that's a very, very different type of writing. And then a book, of course, is a marathon. And there are different kinds of books that I've written. I've ghostwritten books in other people's voices, which is a really great literary experiment and trick to try, which I've always really enjoyed because it teaches you a lot about voice and writing and dialogue. And then there are, you know, history books that I've written, like The Real All-Americans, which was heavily researched, you know, a historical narrative. It's all a different exercise, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So what kind of pieces that you write draw the most response or the most feedback?
Well, you know, the column is very dangerous because you really could stray into clickbait pretty quickly. You know, the hot take is always tempting. And so, you know, I'm as guilty of that sometimes as anybody. I mean, you know, the Deflategate columns that I wrote about Tom Brady and Roger Goodell's, you know, face-off over the last 18 months probably generated as much traffic as anything I've ever written. But you have to realize that a lot of that is, you know, partisan fans. The same thing with the Penn State stuff. I mean, you know, invariably anything about Penn State just, you know, absolutely makes the temperature rise. But a lot of times those are, you know, Penn State truthers, people who are just feel large outrage on the subject of child molestation, as we all do. And so, you know, you don't always want to just go for the best read subject or the one that's just going to outrage people. That's kind of a trap. You try to surprise people too. And sometimes what's really gratifying is to write, you know, something that you feel is more subtle and a little bit off the beaten path. And when that generates traffic, you feel like you really, you know, told someone something they didn't already know.
Sally, one of the interesting things about you, you write for The Washington Post, so many of your readers obviously are in that area. You do live in New York, but you told a interviewer not too long ago, and I thought it was a really interesting answer, about who reads you and the feedback that you get in terms of who's reading you. And it's not your run-of-the-mill audience per se, right? It's generals. It could be, you know, listen, it could be spooks. It could be CIA officials. It could be heads of government agencies. Do you have a sense of who reads you, especially the column in the Post?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it's an incredibly influential and diverse readership in Washington, D.C. It's a real privilege to write for those people. I mean, you get notes from federal judges and generals and, you know, yeah, I think there's probably a spook or two in that crowd, too. You know, I mean, I one of the most surprising things is I became correspondents with a brigadier general. You know, I mean, it's just really and a guy from the Supreme Court. So it's really a fascinating thing to write for such a diverse, deeply knowledgeable readership in some ways. You know, and to play with that audience is a lot of fun because it really helps you open up a column. I mean, if you're going to take on an issue, you want to make sure you've done some homework and sort of, you know, go to school a little bit because, you know, there's a bunch of people waiting to jump on you if you get it wrong.
Sally, in terms of living in one city and writing in another city, how do you sort of manage that? Because there would be, you know, there's probably a fair, there's some fair criticism to say that every sports columnist should live in the city that they write about. At the same time, the counter would be the Washington Post isn't really a local paper per se. It's a national paper, obviously. So what's your
right?
So how do you sort of weigh those two things?
Because
many of the pieces that you write, obviously, sometimes you'll write about the Redskins, but often if you're writing about doping in the Olympics, that's not a DC story. That's a national story.
All right. So you have to be careful that you stay in touch with. You know, I try to go to I go to a half a dozen Redskins games. I mean, I go to as many Redskins games as I can, both on the road and at home in D.C. I probably saw 6 or 7 games last year. You know, when the Capitals come up and play the Rangers, I mean, I've covered their playoff runs. You know, they've played the New York Rangers, so that's actually made it fairly easy for me to stay in touch with the Capitals. I don't do a lot of Washington Nationals, but then I don't do a lot of baseball, period. It's just not a strength of mine. I'm not real. It's not something I particularly have ever written about. So you try to balance things that are, you know, immediately local to the fan base in Washington with the larger national and international topics. And, you know, I'm very lucky. The Washington Post is a national and an international institution. It does open the subject matter quite a lot. I think it would be different if I was a Washington, D.C. resident trying to write about New York City teams. Maybe that would be a different deal. I'm not sure. But, the other thing is, I happen to think it's a bit of an asset. I think it's been easier for me to be critical of the Washington Redskins. I think maybe I have a slightly more dispassionate eye, not just because I'm a New Yorker, but because I'm a woman, possibly, and I just don't get quite so caught up in the historical reverence for the team in town. I don't know. Maybe, I mean, that's not to say my male colleagues haven't been as critical, but I think maybe, I've never cared what the owner thought of me, for instance, at all. I just don't have to deal with him as much. So maybe that's made it easier to be critical of him. And that's something you have to be careful about too, and make sure you're not being unfair. So yeah, it's an interesting job that way.
The, historically, I don't know if this exists anymore in 2016, but the Washington Post did have the reputation, at least among its top management, of being very much, Redskins flag waivers. I don't think the coverage per se from the reporters and the columnists necessarily reflected that. But has that changed in the last decade or two? Is the what we used to hear about sort of post management really making sure they were at Redskin games and sort of flag waving? Is it has that sort of alliance or allegiance receded?
I just think that Dan Snyder has had so much tension with the media in general. And since we're right there, that tension has been quite naturally most pronounced with us. But maybe more with a guy named Dave McKenna, who wrote for the Washington, Dave McKenna didn't even work for us. So, I mean, Snyder has tension with the press, period. And he tries to control the subject, period. So that's natural, I think that in general, there's nothing wrong with the hometown paper, whether it's the Boston Globe or the Washington Post or the New York Post, with, understanding readers' devoted loyalty to these institutions and feeding that and giving people what they want and what they enjoy. That's not homerism. That's serving your customer and your reader. What you is you just try not to tilt one way or the other. And, I happen to feel that the Washington Redskins organization disserved its fan base for a lot of years with amateurism. And, all I ever wanted was for Dan Snyder to bring in a competent general manager. Well, they've finally done that, and they're reaping the rewards of it. So I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so.
It's always a good sports columnist to mention that.
I don't think the Washington Post has a relationship with the Washington Redskins that's any different from any other major hometown paper.
One more about sort of your post job. Then I want to get into Pat Summitt. It's one of the reasons I wanted to interview this week. You, unlike some of your the colleagues of your generation, it strikes me that you never wanted to become a television personality. Obviously, famously, Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon have had longtime success on Pardon the Interruption, almost to the point where I think most young people now don't even know, have no idea about their careers prior to being on television and being pundits, and the fact that they had long careers at the Washington Post, including Kornheiser, didn't even always work in sports, worked in Style and other places. But this strike, Sally, it strikes me that while these opportunities may have existed, you were never one who wanted to be part of the sports reporters circuit or to be part of the around the horn PTI brigade. Why is that?
I mean, I just never pursued it. I never wanted to worry about my appearance. I think that's part of it. It just never really appealed to me that much. Number one. Number two, I feel like for a committed writer, television can be a little dangerous just because it's very easy money for the work compared to writing. And writing, do a lot of TV, I think, and start making a lot of money at it, it can make writing feel very, very hard. And so maybe I was always a little guarded about that. To be quite frank, I wasn't particularly invited to do a whole lot of TV. I've done some, but I don't think anybody ever sort of said, hey, you could make a great TV star. So I don't know. It just didn't happen. And I can honestly say, I think I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing.
That's interesting what you just said there, because I tend to agree with you that, as great as television is for the rewards of, financial rewards, and who wouldn't want that, obviously, it does strike me that the more you do TV and the more maybe you do radio becomes your primary home, the more you get away from writing, and maybe even the more that you're enabled and have your ass kissed by people who are seeing you on television, specifically the management who put you on there, you do get away from the charter of writing. Have you, you don't have to name names, but have you seen, because I certainly have you seen people become a little bit too intoxicated with that world, and it hurts them as writers, or maybe even they don't even write anymore?
You know, I wouldn't call it intoxicated, but like, I remember watching The Example as a very young, in high school and then in college, and then very early in my 20s, I remember watching The Example of Pete Axtell, who was one of the great, great sports writers.
Yeah.
for Newsweek magazine. And he wrote a couple of really, really just beautiful books. And then Pete got on TV, on one of the NFL Sunday shows, and I think made great money doing TV and became sort of prominent in TV. I wouldn't say intoxicated with it, but he certainly became a lot less productive as a writer, and it was just a lot easier for him to make a living from TV money. And I can remember sort of watching that and thinking that maybe it was a little bit too bad because I missed his writing. That's the main thing I remember thinking. And I think I've had Pete in the back of my mind a little bit at times. Michael Wilbon is still a hugely productive writer. He writes for ESPN. I think he has a genuine love for what he's doing, and his devotion to it remains unchanged. Tony Kornheiser genuinely fell out of love with writing. I thought he was the most brilliant sports writer of his generation. His long form pieces were just tremendous. But I think he lost a taste for it long before he became a TV star. I think he, as you say, started doing style pieces. His interest changed. You know, I think that's the main thing that happened with Tony. So, you know, everybody's different. I just sort of, writing is hard. And if you find something else that pays better, it could really kind of undermine your devotion to the job, because the job's, writing's hard. It's breaking rocks with a shovel. and so I just have always been a little bit wary of things that might feel easier.
And we should mention, for people who are younger listening to this, Pete Axtell, check out The City Game. Google that. One of the great books of all time. And Pete Axtell, go ahead.
He wrote the book about Steve Cawthon, the kid.
That's right. And he went to NBC. That was where he eventually landed on television, and his incredible work in Newsweek. You can probably Google it. He's one of the great sports writers of his generation. Sally, you more than I think any other writer in this country reflected Pat Summitt's voice and words over the course of her basketball life. What made Pat Summitt for you such an interesting subject?
Oh, God, she was fascinating. I mean, you're only as good as your material as a ghostwriter or a sports writer, and she was just epic. I mean, you know, first of all, Pat had so many contradictory qualities, and that was fascinating. She was majestic but humble. She was also very, very kind. She was certainly flawed like anybody else. Certainly no saint, but just a really interesting mix of qualities. And, I mean, just the game's great, great teachers, and the life's great teachers, even though I hate, that's a cliche, but it happens to be true in her case. I think, we were put together by agents and lawyers. It started out as a professional job. I was brought on to her book, her autobiography. She was just so interesting and so much fun. We stayed friends, and then it grew into a friendship over the years. Two more books with her, mainly for fun, to tell you the truth, because I just being around her and her program and lifting the lid on Ferrari, you know, that was the great Tennessee program. You know, here's the interesting thing, though, that I think people miss about Pat. Pat didn't start out to be, you know, the all-time winningest basketball coach. When she started coaching, there was no WNBA. There was no future for female basketball players. There wasn't much of a future for female basketball coaches. I mean, the pay, gym teachers' pay, there was no wealth in front of her. The only thing she was interested in doing was turning out college-educated young women who could support themselves in the workplace, who wouldn't have to depend on a man for their living. That is what she started out to do in life. And that is really what she did her entire career. That's what she was focused on. She was focused on creating strong young women who could support themselves. And that never changed, even though she ended up making $2 million a year and creating all these Olympians and WNBA stars. You have to understand, she didn't get famous until very, or well paid, until very, very, very late in life. And that fascinated me.
Yeah.
There was a purity to that you don't find much anymore. She was a real teacher. She was the real thing. She wasn't looking to get rich, and she wasn't looking to get famous. She was just looking to be a great teacher. And I so admired that and so loved watching it. So that's what really interested me the most, and what drew me and what kept me hanging around was, as a sports writer, you see so few things that you feel are that sort of pure in their intentions. You know, she didn't want to get rich. She didn't want to get famous. She became both of those things. But what she really set out to be and what she really was one of the world's great teachers.
So this is interesting to me, because obviously I cover women's basketball. So I've always been fascinated by Summit. I interviewed many times, not nowhere near, obviously, the amount of times you did. And you, as really her main collaborator, who then became someone who was part of the inner circle, you know, a friend or however you describe it, a best friend. At a certain point, the idea of objectivity with Pat seems to me an impossibility. So in your own mind, what kind of jiu-jitsu did you do in terms of writing about someone who you really became friends with, that you knew intimately?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing I did was not write about her. I wrote with her. I didn't write about her. I finally, when she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I wrote about her, I think, maybe twice before the Alzheimer's. When she won 1,000 games, I think we agreed in the office, when she hit the 1,000 game mark, I think we agreed in the office that it was worth me writing a column about. But generally, I don't recall ever writing about her in the Washington Post, for the simple reason that I had been her collaborator, and that you really, you know, unless it's really important, you feel you have something really interesting and revealing to say, I generally tried to stay away from writing about Pat. I mean, I would go to Final Fours and write about all the other teams,
right?
But not Tennessee, for instance. So that's number one. Once she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and she asked me to be the one to break the news, you know, that was a whole different circumstance. And I sat down and called my editors, talked to both the managing editor and the editor in chief of the paper. And we had a discussion about whether it was the right thing for me to do. And if the editors had felt it wasn't the right thing for me to do, we were going to have someone else do it, you know, simply tell Pat, I can't do it. But the paper agreed that that it was fine. And so I did it. I would have given anything not to have written that, had to have written that story.
Right.
You know, and then when she passed, it came. And, you know, the couple of columns came flying out, and, you know, they woke me up at 4 a.m. and wrote themselves, and I would send them to my editor and say, you know, if you feel this is inappropriate, spike it. And they printed them. So, you know, the main thing you try to do is you just stay in very close touch with your editor, and you have, you know, good, very self-confessional talks with your editor and say, this is how I feel. This is what I would write. You tell me if you think it's the right or the wrong thing to do. And as long as you do that, I think you're on pretty safe ground. And I've just always tried to do that, whether it was Pat, whether it was Lance Armstrong.
Was it, and I'll get to Lance. Was this your sports editor who you had these conversations with, or even above the sports department?
Well, certainly my sports editor, Matt Vita, has always been great to talk to. But, you know, for instance, when Pat got Alzheimer's, I talked to my managing editor, Liz Spade, and also Pat's lawyer, Bob Barnett of Williams & Connolly, talked to Marcus Brockley, who was then the editor-in-chief.
Wow.
And so, you know, everybody put their heads together and conferred over whether it was the right thing.
What stood out to you most about Pat's final days?
I'm sorry, what's the question?
What stood out to you most about Pat's final days? Because I believe you were in Knoxville with her prior to her passing.
You know, Rich, what stood out was what Pat built was a real thing. The love that her players had for her. That was the main thing that stood out was the depth feeling that her coaches, her colleagues, and even some of her opposing coaches, referees came to her funeral. I mean, a couple of officials came. She was so much fun, and she was so full of surprising humor and mischief, in addition to greatness. And you know, the depth of people's feeling for Pat was the thing that stood out. You know, kids drove all night long, 14, 16 hours to get to her just to hold her hand one more time. You know, flying across country, things like that. And you just realized that it hadn't been lip service. The devotion to each other between her and her players was very, very real.
Yeah, I can hear the emotion in your voice, Sally. I appreciate you answering that. It strikes me that in addition to her her greatness, her competitive greatness, her public fight with Alzheimer's is going to really be her legacy. And I think because they're along with, you know, there's others too, but Pat is really now a face of the Alzheimer's fight. And I think that's ultimately going to lead to a lot of money and hopefully a cure. Before the very end, Sally, did you get a sense that Pat understood that that she was going to, this was going to be part of sort of who she was, and that she was ultimately going to help people after she passed?
Oh yeah, I mean, she was very clear about that. I mean, what was weird was, and I wrote this in the paper, Pat knew something was wrong with her. She didn't know what. And she told me probably 4 months before she was diagnosed, there's something more I'm supposed to be doing. And I said, so, I mean, I laughed at her. I teased her. I said, so, you know, changing everything for American women and winning 8 national championships isn't enough. You think you're supposed to be doing more? And she said, no, I'm serious. I really feel it. And at the time, she thought maybe she was very involved with a charity that helped abused women. She thought maybe it was domestic violence or maybe it was child abuse. She wasn't sure, but she knew there was something bigger she was supposed to be working for. And she'd always done quite a lot of that work. And then the Alzheimer's came and it was kind of like, whoa, I mean, she knew, you know? And so she was right from the start, right from the diagnosis, completely certain that she was supposed to go public, that she was supposed to, you know, in her words, let God use the disease. You know, I mean, I remember her saying, she would always say grace before dinner at her house. And I can remember her saying, you know, Lord, do with me as you will with this disease. She believed she was given it for a reason. Hmm. She believed that she was supposed to use it for other people's welfare. And so she launched her foundation immediately. She didn't want flowers at her funeral. She wanted people to go to patsummit.org and donate to the Pat Summit Alzheimer's Clinic, which is going to be opening its doors in December at UT Medical Center.
Wow. One final one on Pat, and I can respect it if you don't want to answer it, but I do want to ask it, and that is, did she have any idea of what took place with Tyler before she passed?
I don't believe she did. I hadn't seen Pat during that time. By the time I got to Knoxville, I got to see her and talk to her a little bit, but she was pretty non-responsive. And so I really can't answer that question. I do know that some pretty great lengths were gone to sort of try to, I think people tried not to tell her and kind of hoped that that she wasn't, you know, particularly aware of it. You know, and how successful or unsuccessful that was, I really couldn't tell you. I can tell you this: Pat was really sharp and sensitive. You know, to me, whenever I saw her, it really wasn't a great strategy to try to fool her. You know what I mean?
The answer to that question
is I really don't know.
I appreciate that. You know, the coach there is now Holly Warlick, who is a longtime Pat assistant and a great player at the University of Tennessee. They had a nice run last year, at least to get to the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament. Sally, I know you follow the women's game like I do. As it projects forward, you think Tennessee can? Tennessee's never going to be what they were with Pat because these are once in a generation kind of things. Same with Geno. But do you think Tennessee can return to a top five year in, year out program, or is this, or do we have to sort of recalibrate what we think of Tennessee now? And they're a top 15 program. Maybe if they get the right recruiting class, they got a shot at a Final Four.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, Holly's been to three Final Eights. It's not like she's an unaccomplished coach. If you remove the filter of Pat Summitt and Tennessee, I think most programs in the country would be thrilled with Final Eights in
true,
5 years. So, you know, I think you have to start there. I think Holly Warlick has done the single most difficult thing anybody can do in coaching, which is follow the all-time winningest coach in history, male or female. And it takes enormous guts and enormous steel to do that. And I think she's done a tremendous job. And I'll say something else. No matter how long you've been an understudy to Pat Summitt, it is just different sitting in the big chair. And I think that, you know, Holly is learning some things as she goes, just like anybody would. It's very different when you're the one pulling the triggers. I think she's done a hell of a job. And so at any rate, three Final Eights, that makes you one of the top eight programs in the entire country. That's pretty rare air. You know, I know everybody wants Final Four, and nobody more than Holly. I mean, they've run into the Baylors and the Notre Dames are certainly Kim Mulkey and Muffet McGraw are going to go down as some among the greatest coaches in history as well. I don't know. We'll see. It'll be interesting. I think Holly's gotten a little bit more sure of herself every year. And I also, by the way, don't ever forget that Holly Warlick has been in the process of losing her one of her closest friends and godmothers. She's had a lot to deal with. So I really congratulate her on what she's done.
Yeah, and you made the right point, is that everything is sort of compared under the prism of Pat. And if you step away from that, the program has definitely been successful. The NBA free agent season has been absolutely bonkers, with about $3 billion changing hands over the first 96 hours. On SI's NBA podcast Open Floor, Andrew Sharp and Ben Golliver give listeners the inside story on the wild offseason. Find Open Floor on iTunes, Stitcher, and your favorite podcast app, as well as at SI.com podcast. That's Open Floor, who are starting to overtake the media podcast is the top SI podcast. Open Floor on iTunes, Stitcher, and your favorite podcast app. All right, I want to, as we sort of spend the last part here, I want to read you something that you said about Lance Armstrong in an interview. And that was, our friendship was never based on what he did on a bike. My respect was never based on what he did on a bike. My enjoyment was based on his softer, funnier side that people rarely see. I got the very best of Lance. I never had to race against him or be his adversary. Obviously, my Lance is his very best side. I'm not happy that I was deceived by him, but he apologized in a very heartfelt way, and I accept it. You said that, I think, 2 or 3 years ago. Is that where you stand today with Lance Armstrong? Same sentiment.
Absolutely, and it's funny. Now that you read that back, I'm glad I said that, because I don't think I could say it better. that's very much how I feel about him. You know, look, I think Lance made some terrible mistakes. I think his biggest mistake was not coming to me and saying, I have something I need to tell the world and I need your help. I think if he had done that, he would be having a much different experience in public these days. So that's how I feel about it. You know, I have to say, you know, I don't think he was the only person in cycling who lied. I think that performance enhancement was the baseline of the sport, as it turns out, even in an era in which they were claiming to be cleaner than they ever had been. It's complicated. I don't have the moral clarity on doping that other people do. I don't think it's the crime of the century. I think we're real paternalistic about it. I think we may look back someday, you know, 50 years from now, a half century from now, and feel like doping was the sort of, you know, amateurism versus professionalism of its day. You know, we look back and we feel like we did Jim Thorpe a real disservice for disgracing him over earning a little bit of money playing baseball. I think someday we're going to look back on the generation of athletes that we hurled disgrace at for doping and say that maybe we were a little overly judgmental and unjust, and that our so-called purity code was maybe not the smartest, deepest thinking we ever did.
It's interesting. I don't ask this with any kind of pejorative nature. I just ask it straight, and mm-hmm. that is there any part of you that that feels bad, guilty, whatever the emotion would be, about being a collaborator in what was ultimately a published lie, even if you did not know that what was being published was a lie?
Sure. I mean, you know, the book I'm not proud of is the second book. I remain pretty proud of It's Not About the Bike. That's a book about cancer. His fight against cancer was thoroughly authentic. I really don't take issue with that book. The doping discussion in the second book, I obviously cringe at. You can't do anything with that. And that's obviously the most upsetting part of the whole deal. Now, I will say this, too. I interviewed not just Lance, but everybody around Lance. And a lot of the people who later became, you know, his most ardent accusers were Shirley Temple when I was interviewing them. Right. I interviewed Tyler Hamilton at length, not just about Lance. I wrote a column about Tyler Hamilton in the Washington Post, lauding him cycling in all kinds of pain. And it later turns out that he was doping as badly as anybody. So, I mean, I'm not happy about that either. But I don't judge Tyler Hamilton any more harshly than I do Lance. Same thing with the Andreus. You know, these are all kids who were trying to make a living, whose career options were really pretty limited. And, you know, whether I'm talking about Marion Jones or Lance Armstrong or Tyler Hamilton, you know, I happen to not have the heart for judging them and drumming them out of American society that other people have. I felt that way about Marion Jones long before Lance Armstrong, so thoroughly disgraced himself.
What do you think the final act or the for Lance will be? What's he going to do, you think, in the next 10 to 20 years, just in terms of dedicating his time and his life? I don't know if you still talk to him, but he now becomes he's always an interesting figure, but you can make the argument he's even now more of an interesting figure depending on what he's going to do now for the next 25 years.
You know, Lance is a really smart guy. I mean, obviously he wasn't as smart as he thought he was. And if he'd figured that out sooner, again, he'd be having a different experience. But, you know, he's got real, real native intelligence. He's a smart investor. He's a very bright guy. I think he's devoted to his kids. He spends most of his time, I think, just being a father, to tell you the truth. He still exercises heavily. I do stay in touch with him. His father-in-law has Alzheimer's disease. So we were in touch when Pat was slipping away. Mm. He remains a friend of mine, and I still retain a good deal of affection and respect for him. I think he's, you know, I think he has a lot to say about doping and competition. I think he's got some good ideas about how to make things better for everybody. I hope when I think he's probably still got some problems to settle with the federal government, but I think he could become a very useful voice in sports.
So I want to ask you one or two quick ones on Joe Paterno, and this is something you said not too long ago. I simply am puzzled that he spent a career preaching moral strength, and then in the biggest crisis of his career, resorted to buck passing and compartmentalizing. The Paterno story continues to, in 2016, we see more allegations and we find out more things. As someone who conducted the last interview, at least long-form interview with Joe Paterno before he passed, where do you stand on this guy as a subject? It's very hard to sort of It's very hard to figure out what to think of Joe Paterno. I think outside of the fact that, I mean, I know how I feel, and I feel, I think sort of as you do, is that he, in the end, I think he passed the buck. I think he compartmentalized all this stuff, and he has a family that wants to, and understandably so, preach the legacy of Joe Pa, but I think the evidence against him is, quite frankly, rather overwhelming.
Well, I think Joe Paterno said himself, not just to me, but to other people, he wished he had done more. I mean, that's not a criticism of Paterno. That's simply repeating, you know, what he himself said, and it's repeating his own judgment of himself and his action or inaction. You know, I mean, I think it's really that simple. He did an enormous amount of good for a long, long time. You know, he certainly ran a terrific program, and there's no, you know, you look at the loyalty of his players to him, and you see that he was truly a, you know, an educator, a fine educator for a lot of years. The collective question of how a Jerry Sandusky could have prospered the way he did in that environment involves so many more people and questions than just what Joe Paterno did or should have done. You know, it's really an enormous question that's very hard to get your hands around. I think you can't possibly talk about Joe Paterno without talking about Tim Curley and Graham Spanier and Gary Schultz.
Right.
You know, at the university, there, a lot of people. You know, we should be asking the same questions about a lot of people, you know, other coaches, assistant coaches, you know, there were a lot of staffers, you know, and you just would like to know what they saw and what they heard and if they had qualms and whether there were indications that collectively could have saved a lot of children. You know, that's the big question. And that's so much bigger than just one man.
So when you write about Paterno, even today, is there any enjoyment in it, or is it just something that has to be done?
It's just tough. It's just a very tough subject, and it's made tougher by the fact, you know, I really like his family. They're great people, and you know that it causes some distress, and you hate to do it. I'm not the one who sued the insurer, Penn State. You know, these stories continue because Penn State has taken certain actions that have kept this in the news. You know, Penn State sued its insurance company, and so victim had to be deposed all over again. Those depositions were made public. And, you know, as a columnist and as someone who, you know, had one of the final interviews with Paterno, you know, when that stuff breaks, you can't sit on your hands and not take it on just because, you know, it's going to distress people at Penn State.
Final two questions I have for you, Sally. Who do you read to get better as a writer?
Oh, gosh. Well, some of them are alive and some of them are dead. I go back and read Red Smith and Jim Murray quite a lot. I go back and read, I read some of my dad's stuff, you know, obviously. I read a lot of people you might not expect. Like, I love Anthony Lane at The New Yorker.
Yep.
I always read him to get fired up. I read Martin Amis has a great collection of essays that I turn to a lot. It varies. I mean, I love Deadspin. I read the guys at Deadspin all the time. I think Tommy Craggs is one of the great American sports writers. Will Leach, Drew McGarry. I mean, all the guys writing. My own colleagues, Chuck Culpepper, you know, Liz Clark, Dave Shine. I mean, I'm working for the New York Yankees of sports writing right now. I mean, it is slugger's row. You can't pick up the Washington Post sports section without reading some sublime piece by Barry Sparrugia or Dave Shinen or Adam Kilgore or Liz Clark that doesn't make you just want to get better.
Yeah, Post is excellent. Mentioned now, Craggs is now at Slate. Dave Shinen is, I hate this tag because it's someone who will inevitably say that, you know, this person is really this. But you really make the argument Dave Shinen is one of the most underrated sports writers in the country because his name is not so big in the way other prominent people are. But, man, that guy delivers time and time again on copy. He is really talented.
Yeah. Well, and so does Rick Mace.
Yeah, another talented
guy. You know, again, I mean, you can't name a Jerry Brooks can't name somebody who's worked Dan Steinberg. I mean, honestly, every name you could drop at our section, you go, oh yeah, oh God, yeah, that's one of the best. You know, that's one of the best.
No, there's no doubt. So the Post has one of the best in the country.
Tom Boswell. I mean, you know, it's really a fun place to work, and I mean, honestly, I read more of them than anybody, and they make you want to get better because you just want to keep company with them.
Yeah, tell Bezos to buy Sports Illustrated, Sally, if you see him anytime soon. I'd like to. It seems like it's a good place to work. last one, and this is I say this, and I think it's a fairly objective thing to say. You may be the most prominent woman sports writer, female sports writer in the country. I'm not saying most prominent personality. I'm using specifically saying sports writing with writing as the specific word I'm using. How optimistic, as you look forward, are you about women getting prominent writing roles in sports as you head forward? You know, there's a generation before you who fought for access in the locker room. Mm-hmm. You're part of a prominent generation of women really coming to the fore in terms of being opinionists. Linda Robertson, yourself. Yeah. There's still not a ton of you. So where do you think this will be in 2025 and 2030 for young girls who are now 14 or 15 who want to write sports, not just be on ESPN, but they want to actually write?
You know, if you look at our section and you see somebody like Chelsea Janes covering the Nationals, you feel real encouraged. I think the larger question is how much kids are going to want to write hard copy, period.
Yeah, good question.
You know, that's the bigger question. You know, so I think the one question goes hand in hand with the how many people are going to want to write for mainstream newspapers, period. So, and I feel good about that because I feel like institutions like the Washington Post are remaining, you know, viable, attractive places to work. Now, there's more competition. You know, young sports writers are going to websites and not just newspapers. So we have to be sure that we keep making ourselves attractive, forward-looking places to work. But I think most people recognize now that, you know, being a female sports writer is kind of like being left-handed. You know, it used to be an inferiority, and now I think it's viewed as sort of an interesting quirk. You know, and I like that about it. I think people genuinely feel that the female sports writing voice is a useful one, and a different one. I believe in being unashamedly different. It doesn't mean inferior. Difference does not mean inferiority. It's actually more diversity. The argument for diversity is not that it's justice or that it's the law. The argument for diversity is that it's smarter and more interesting. And I think young writers like Chelsea Janes show that.
That's well said. Sally Jenkins has been the guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, as someone who sat next to her during women's basketball games. It's always enjoyable to see her go off on the refs, whether online or in person. She is a columnist for the Washington Post. You also know her work from many best-selling books on sports. Sally, listen, it's been a long time coming, and through some technical glitches, we appreciate you sticking with us and joining us today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Thank you so much. All right, the MLB season has passed the All-Star break, and now it's getting very exciting. And SI's baseball podcast, The Strike Zone, will be taking listeners all the way to the World Series. It's always interesting conversation when Ted Keith and Steve Kinella get together on The Strike Zone. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, your favorite podcast app, or at si.com/podcast. All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Sally Jenkins. I should note, before we bring Bet Marston in here, we got some good interviews coming up, including Otto Bolton and Rowdy Gaines. We're going to combine some Olympic analysts. I know Bet's excited about that. Andy Roddick will be a future guest as well. But I'll bring in Bet Marston now, who is itching to talk about Sally's thoughts on Lance Armstrong.
I don't know. It was very interesting to hear her talk about the books that she's written with him and how she I guess I respect her that she still respects him. Is that something that's fair for me to say? Also, like, kind of an unpopular opinion, but, you know, I I agree with her point where she's like, you know, the way the doping that he did, like, isn't the worst thing in the world, you know, what isn't the absolute most terrible thing going on in the world, like at that time or right now, or, you know, whatever you, however you want to put that into perspective. You know, everyone around them is doing it, as we all now know. And it's, I mean, obviously it's unfortunate the sport fell to that type of stuff, but I don't know. The perception around Lance was so different back then. And then because everyone felt cheated, everyone just turned away from him immediately. But those, if you took a closer look at the sport even back then, you could realize, you could see that Lance wasn't the only one. They were all doing it.
Well, the one thing I'd say is I agree. I hear what you're saying. I agree with you on the sort of the whole like idea of we're moralists when it comes to doping. So I understand. I'm with you and Sally a little bit on that. Where I can't be with you totally is I think Lance was an absolutely horrible human being to a lot of people. He hurt a lot of people who were far less powerful than him. And so he has to forget about owning it. He deserves the scorn for that. In terms of, do I believe essentially everybody was doping during that time of the Tour de France? Absolutely. I don't think everybody was as horrible to people as Lance Armstrong.
Oh, Lance 100% dragged down so many people that did not deserve to be dragged down and didn't – like he just ruined so many people who didn't need to be ruined.
Right. So it's interesting. I mean, listen, you know, she answered the question and it's always a tricky spot for him. She's his biographer. You know, if you're a biographer of somebody, it's like Poznanski with Paterno. If you're a biography of a guy who's, you know, who the public who is a polarizing figure, you're always going to sort of have to answer for that. But that was a really, I thought Sally was really, really interesting. She's covered so many interesting events. We didn't even get into her dad, who's a legendary figure in sports writing, including a longtime figure at SI.
I will say that's also impressive that we could have an entire podcast just about her and like not even talk about her dad. Because I feel like so many people, if you are the, you know, the offspring of somebody famous, conversation often begins and ends around that. But
Sally Jenkins,
she's made a name for herself. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, her career speaks for itself. And in today's parlance, she's more famous or more well-known than Dan Jenkins. No disrespect to Dan Jenkins. That's just sort of, you know, where we are in 2016. All right. Thank you, Bette Marston, for producing this podcast. Thank you to the guys Panoply, including Dan Bloom. And thanks to Chris Stone, John Wertheim, Ryan Hunt, and whoever else supports these fine podcasts. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.